Hey, everybody. It's Dave Fitch here with Mike Moore, Theology on Mission podcast. I can't believe we're even actually getting to the podcast. Folks, we had a little bit of, a few incidental issues having to do with one of the members of the podcast team not being on time. I won't mention who. But we're here now, and we're glad to be here, aren't we, Mike Moore?
I'm so glad you decided to show up, Fitch. So glad that you're here.
Ooh, ouch. Okay, reveal. Not very kind of you. Folks, we've had other issues as well, but we're working those out, too. We have Chaz with us. Chaz, you want to say something? I mean, he's the new technology dude here, and things are going so smoothly. If the people who actually do the podcast would show up on time. Do you want to say something, Chaz?
That would help. I get more than 2 seconds this time.
No, that's it. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we're so great. Theology on Mission podcast, where theology engages the issues of culture for Christ and his mission. We are so glad you made it, all five of you, to listen to our podcast today. We might have a few more listeners
that's
today,
right,
though, Mike Moore, because we got a very... very, very special guest. His name is Dr. Alan Noble. He is professor of English. By the way, your picture, Alan, whoa. I wish I could look that good, that smooth, that hip, that cool. It's never going to happen in my lifetime. But Alan Noble is professor of English at Oklahoma Baptist University. He's co-founder of Christ and Pop Culture, a great website, by the way. And his writing credentials, he's got too many credits for me to. We got to get to the podcast, Alan. We can't actually go through 52 different things you've written. I hope you will forgive us. But welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here finally.
Yeah, it's good to have you, Alan.
Wait, did you say finally?
Well, you know.
Who said finally?
Somebody said finally. It's hard to tell. Could have been anybody.
We're finally glad to have you finally get on the podcast. Folks, Alan Noble's book entitled On Getting Out of Bed is a great book. Rarely have I written as good of a review on any book as I did on this book. And I'm not talking about the quality of the genius of the review. I'm talking about it's a good review because it's a great book. And the review was pretty good, too. But anyways... this book is serious, folks. It's engaging, but it is a deep exploration into the human struggle with mental illness from a very unique perspective. And so, Dr. Noble, do you want me to call you Doctor? Do you want me to call you Alan?
You can call me Alan.
Alan, okay. Alan it is then. If you don't mind, could you please call me Fitch, though? Could you please call me Dr. Reverend? The great fit. No, I'm just kidding. Just call me Fitch.
Okay. Happy to.
We're going to keep this podcast on the rails, eh?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit, Alan, about, why. This is a daring book. It is a revealing book, a self-revealing book. Why? What drove you to get to the point of writing a book like this? And by the way, it is a compelling account of the struggle we have with mental illness and its relationship to theology. Tell us how you got there.
Yeah, well, I was going through my own personal struggles and thinking a lot about what it means to go through suffering and how we go through suffering and why we go through suffering when somebody who is fairly high profile in the Christian community, or at least fairly well known, took their own life. And it got me... that instance got me thinking about what that act communicates to other people. And it struck me that, you know, in that moment, part of what's communicated to other people is that when suffering comes, life is not worth living. And that was a dour thing to contemplate. But then I thought about the flip side, which is that when we choose to suffer, and we choose to get out of bed and continue going through life, we're communicating to people that life is worth living and that that is an exciting thing, that we actually get to bear witness to the goodness of being by choosing to embrace life. And so that spurred me on to write an essay called On Living that several people said was my my best writing. And at that time, I was editing my second book, You Are Not Your Own. And when you're in the editing phase of a book, you'll notice this. The editing phase, you're kind of sick of the book. You're convinced the book is not any good, and you're ready to be done with the book and get it out there. And so I was feeling pretty down about this book that I'd spent years working on. And people were emailing me saying, this essay about life is the best thing you've written. So I thought, I don't want to write this book. I want to write that book. And so I emailed my editor, and that's how that came to be.
Yes. Yes. An exploration of the struggles of mental illness. And it's a very personal book. You know, it's like as you turn every page of this book, you're sorting through various issues of mental struggle. And by the way, it doesn't read like a medical journal article. It doesn't even read like a theology book. It's like you're taking this into the depths of what it is to experience mental illness. Did you find that? Well, that was daring. Did you find it? I mean, put yourself out there in such plain terms. And that had to be a scary, scary, triple double scary thing.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I had to make some decisions. I could have written a memoir, and that would have been one way of writing this book. I could have written a theology self-help book. That would have been another way of writing this. But instead, I chose to write what I describe as a kind of letter from a friend who really cares about you, who wants you to understand that what you're going through is seen and heard and felt, and you are loved, and your struggles are seen. Because one of the things that you experience when you go through a time of difficulty is you feel isolated, you feel alone, you feel like your experience is radically individual and not communicable. And so I wanted it to be kind of like a letter from a friend. And I intentionally chose, it was scary because it's not really a genre of its own. I wasn't sure what I was doing. And I wasn't sure how much to share of my own struggles and how much not to. And so there was some tension there between me and my editor, trying to figure that out, trying to figure out that balance. I didn't want to make this book about me and my stories because that's a perfectly fine kind of book genre, but I really wanted to make this about the human experience. And so I pulled back. I tried to tell stories, but not make stories about me. And so it was difficult. There was a lot of wrestling with words.
Alan, you're writing in a genre that is very challenging, and yet it's disrupting. You're reading this, and now you are inside an experience. And I must say, to any of the audience, whether you have experienced mental illness to a small degree, big degree, this is something. This is a book that both I think anyone can relate to, but it helps us all, no matter what level of mental illness we personally have experienced, our experience, or going through. It helps us relate to those who are going through it, who are not us. So, anyways, it's a genre. This is a unique genre, and you just finished saying something about how you were struggling with your editor. Did you have to navigate with your editor? Okay, it doesn't fit this genre. It does fit this genre, but you're not doing enough of telling your personal story. Just talk about that issue. And you're an English teacher, professor,
yeah.
So the genre thing is the real thing for you. Tell us how you navigated that a little bit more.
Yeah, so I have a great editor, Ethan McCarthy, who gives me a lot of leeway to experiment. And when I wrote my essay on living, he kind of got a sense of the attitude, the approach that I was taking. And he just trusted me that I knew what I was doing. And I don't know if that was a safe bet, but it worked out. I kind of tried to imagine the kind of letter that you might read in, or the kind of spirit of J.D. Salinger's Franny and Zooey. There are some important letters in J.D. Salinger's little novel or collection of novellas called Franny and Zooey. where siblings are writing to each other these letters of encouragement and advice. And it just seems to me that that genre of what I would call wise counsel or mentorship or loving mentorship is not very common today, but it's what's needed. People need someone to come along and see them and love them with their words. And so that's what I tried to do.
And it was so great. And that's exactly what it felt like. It felt like you were talking to me as someone who could benefit from wisdom on how to walk through the struggle. And I just thought that was great. Now, Mike Moore, I know that I'm hogging the podcast and all the questions, but if you want to chime in, go ahead. But I want to get to some more phenomenology questions, and then I want to get to some theology questions. So if you're going to like pipe in when you like normally do and disrupt all my ways of thinking, just do it anytime.
Yeah. How rude of me to pipe in on the podcast.
Hey, I didn't mean it that way. Okay. Now,
I'm going to echo everything that Fitch said, Alan. Love the book, Winsome and Wise. I was actually hoping I could read a sentence and have you do a little bit of a running commentary on it. Could we do that?
Let's do it.
Page 63, you write, while we have good treatments for most mental disorders, there aren't many cures. So the monotony gets old pretty quick. The patience your loved ones had for you begins to wear down. I was struck by your statement that there aren't many good cures. And I've noticed for a lot of people who struggle with mental illness and even my own struggles, there is a desire to have a cure and have a solution for it. Can you talk a little more about this kind of patience endurance that you're pressing us towards?
Yeah. So we live in this tension because our society is a society of cures. We believe in the miracle of technique. There's always a technique to solve whatever problem that you have. We're taught to believe this in every sphere of our lives. There's an answer to whatever problem that you have. But the real world doesn't work like that. In the real world, there isn't a cure you can pay for most forms of mental illness or mental suffering or affliction. It involves a lot of patient endurance. Now, there are some great treatments, so I never want to discourage someone from pursuing professional help as if there's no point in doing it. There are some great treatments that can help mitigate the suffering, but there aren't a lot of cures. And it's natural to want a cure because you want to get out. But what's really required is that patient endurance. And I think what's hard is that it's not just you having to summon up this endurance for yourself. Your family members, your friends have to summon up this endurance as well, because they're coming alongside you and they're experiencing this with you. And that makes it difficult, because what you're really doing is you're coming to terms with the fact that you're going to have to live with these symptoms in some way and learn how to manage them. And other people are going to have to learn how to manage them as well. Whether you want them to or not, you're going to be a burden to other people. But that, you know, the subtitle of this book is the Burden and Gift of Living. And that burden of being... That challenge of being a burden to other people is also a gift to those people. And that's the flip side of it, is that they get the gift of loving you by walking through your suffering with you.
Yeah.
Good. And that concept of a gift of walking alongside with you, the gift of caring for you. Now, there's something intensely Christian about that. It is a theological formation for me to see walking alongside someone as a gift as opposed to a burden. And so do you think Christians have something very unique to say about how to walk through mental illness? And I think the answer is yes, obviously, after reading the book, but maybe you could summarize an answer to that question.
Yeah. So, I mean... humility, I would say, is key. My favorite poet, T.S. Eliot, says, the only wisdom we can hope to acquire is the wisdom of humility. Humility is endless. that's part of the goal of life, is the pursuit of wisdom for the honor of God. And if that's the case, then acts of humility are gifts to us. And so when you go through somebody's burdens, when you go through suffering with someone, part of what you're learning is the act of humility, the wisdom of humility, which is endless. And you come to experience that and live through that. But of course, we also have the model of our model is Christ himself, who came down as a gift and took on our burdens. So that's the model of what it looks like to love someone, is to suffer for them as a gift.
And it's a unique invitation, I believe, by Christ himself to enter into the suffering of people who are not maybe suffering. You know, Matthew 25, when you give a cup of water to the thirsty, when you provide food to the hungry, when you go visit someone in prison, when you, I am there, that is me. Okay, I believe that is, and I think the early Christians understood it this way, that is saying Jesus is present there. His presence becomes manifest in that practice of being with someone who is suffering. And so we, the early church, this is in this book by Gary Anderson, the Yale historian on charity. The early church would go to be with the poor so that they could encounter the living Christ. And all that to say, folks, that this is our opportunity, our invitation, whether you are in the midst of mental illness or not, to go be with the suffering and encounter the living, resurrected Christ. So I just think that is such a valuable thing that we learn in this book.
I'm going to jump in again. I kind of want to spin off your previous work, Alan, You Are Not Your Own. Can you talk a little bit more about the sense of suffering and autonomy and control? Because what I hear you doing in this book is pushing back against this notion that we can design our own life, that we can curate everything to our own experiences, that we ourselves actually get to tell ourselves and other people who we are. Can you explore a little more about this communal responsibility we have towards each other?
Yeah. So it's interesting because it goes both ways. So for the sufferer, your suffering is not your own. You might want to keep your suffering to yourself and allow. Now, of course, there's always an element in which your suffering can't be fully expressed to anyone but God. But fundamentally, your suffering, you are not your own, and your suffering is not your own. It belongs to other people. And that means that they have a responsibility, a duty, a belonging to you, which invites them to enter into your suffering and work with you and love you and care for you in ways that are important. Now, what's so hard about that is if you buy into the idea that we're crafting an identity and cultivating an identity, then you're not going to want to be vulnerable. You're not going to want to allow people to enter into your suffering because you're going to want to hold yourself safely aside. And I think what we find, you know, one of the things I mentioned early in the book is that there's this kind of paradox where a lot of people are publicly talking about their mental illness and their trauma and their suffering. But I think for most adults, it's still the case that their mental suffering goes unspoken. Most adults. So it's an interesting experience. And social media, people are loud about their mental afflictions. But in the real world, off social media, most adults just keep to themselves. And I think part of the reason we do that is that we feel like we have to keep up a kind of image. And of course, in the church, there's the pressure to keep up an image that being saved means that you are going to be feel joy and peace and harmony all the time, and you won't have any sort of mental afflictions, that the fall somehow won't affect your mind. That's not how things actually work. And so it requires to allow the community in on your suffering allows a lot of vulnerability.
Mm.
Yeah, and we're getting now to the issue of the church and how the church is to respond to and engage with and tend to the needs of those going through mental struggle. And this idea of the church of, there's this, you call it the unspoken conspiracy, that we're all living these great lives, almost like a Disneyfied Christian life.
Yeah.
And so you can't really talk about it. Here's a great quote from page 9, Mike Moore. Noble asks us to think about someone you know who is living the good life. In our minds, oh, they're just living the wonderful. You do this to me a lot, Mike Moore. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have made that a joke. But someone well-dressed, confident, smiling, high-achieving, maybe even attractive and intelligent and funny. And Alan Noble says, 9 times out of 10, they're carrying around something unspeakably painful. How can the church not be a place that fosters the unspoken conspiracy? You have any suggestions on that?
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, the way to do that, let me set it up this way. Part of the problem is finding appropriate spaces to be open to this. When I bump into a friend or an acquaintance in the street or even in church, it's not reasonable for them or for me to divulge serious problems that I've got going on. So when they ask me, how are you doing? If I'm honest with them and say, well, right now I'm going through something and it's really serious, that's not actually an appropriate time. It's not going to be helpful for them. They're not going to be able to minister to me and love me. You know, I might be able to say something like, you know, I'd love to talk to you about that over coffee or something, but I can't really be honest. So part of what we're dealing with is the superficiality on Sunday morning. It's hard to be honest with other people on Sunday morning. But Sunday morning is not the only time that we have with our church community, or it shouldn't be. And so that's when we have to have pockets of community. And for me, that's looked like a lot of small group Bible studies or home groups or things like that, where people meet regularly and there's space and there's time, because that's one of the reasons why it's not really appropriate to divulge all your dirt, your baggage on Sunday morning. There's just not really time often. It's just not practical. And that's okay. That doesn't mean that we have to be superficial, though. So let me pause and say that on Sunday morning, you know, I can say, when somebody asks me how I'm doing, I can say, okay. And I don't have to put a smile on and pretend everything's great. But I also don't have to divulge everything. But what I do want to have is space where I can be vulnerable. And in my experience, what it takes is it takes people having courage to share. When you're in a small group with people, when you're meeting regularly with other Christians, it takes, in order for people to be vulnerable, it takes someone taking the leap of faith that they're going to be safe, that they're in a safe place, and coming out and saying, I'm going through something. And what I've experienced repeatedly is once someone takes that leap, other people feel safe to take that leap because they realize this is a safe place. I'm going to be received. I'm going to be loved. I'm going to be heard. I'm not going to be judged. I'm going to be encouraged. But if no one takes that leap, then those small groups become just as superficial as a greeting on Sunday morning, which doesn't have the space to talk about difficult things. So in my experience, I think what the church needs is people who have courage to speak up.
Yeah. This just is so important, folks listening. We call this the middle circle in our ecclesiology here at Northern Seminary, the places around the table where you spend 2 to 3 hours eating, sharing, listening, and trust grows and a space opens up and the presence of the Lord is there. And coming out of your isolation is just the basic number one thing we need if we're going to be discipled into the kingdom of God. That was so great. Mike Moore, I have one zinger of a question left.
Oh, yeah, me too. So you want to do
yours? You want to go first? You want me to go first?
Yeah, you got it. You got it.
Okay. All right. So, Alan, I call this the backlash. There's several of them in the Church of the United States of America today. But there was a time when therapy was viewed as a sign of weakness for the evangelical fundamentalist. You just need to depend on Jesus more. And the development of psychology then was easily or maybe too easily dismissed early on in evangelical fundamentalism. And, you know, and so we had a reaction to that takes us to the opposite way. And now I'll call my friends progressives at this point. I see that they want to separate therapy from spirituality. Mm-hmm. Separate. No, mental illness is different than breaking your arm. And I go, well, I don't want to separate Jesus from, if I break my arm, I don't want to say, Jesus, I got this, and go to the hospital, get the arm set, and expect everything's going to be okay. I actually want to invite Jesus into that. But there's this overreaction. No.
Yeah.
Mental illness is to be dealt with at the psychiatrist's office. Leave Jesus at home. It's two different things. And I go, no. Can you speak? Have you experienced? Because, folks, I think this book that Alan Noble has written really does just an unbelievable job of seeing how we don't separate one from the other, that they are actually part of the same journey. And under the lordship of Christ, therapy can do some things, but without Christ, it can't do everything. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. And even in my own experience, I won't give details, but I'll say that when I first started having needing to seek help for mental distress, I went to a biblical counselor. So someone who was a fundamentalist who believed that psychologists were these, and that's the tradition I grew up in, was highly skeptical of all psychologists. Psychiatry was this godless practice. And so I went to who I knew, and he was a really kind man, really empathetic man. And one of the last things that he said to me was, Alan, you really need to understand that Christ died on the cross for your sins. And I remember being so mad at him because I thought, I know that. That's not solving my problems. I have a mental illness. This is not it. And so I go to professionals and work with them for years. And at a certain point, one of them basically tells me, because he was a believer, but he had a PhD, you need to understand that Christ died for your sins. And I was like, oh my gosh, wait a minute. I could have taken that advice 10 years ago. And I thought that was so powerful, because it reminded me that exactly what you're saying, these things aren't separate. We want them to be. And there's reasons for that. The reason is secularization. We want to view everything in medical scientific terms, including the soul. That's our default. The other part of it is the professionalization of what used to be mentorship. You know, you talked about these close communities where, you know, the spirit moves and people are vulnerable. Well, I think a lot of people have professionalized their mentorship. So when they go through a difficult time, whether it's a basic passage of life, like the loss of a loved one or some accident or tragedy, they think, I need to go to a professional. And I want to say it's good to go to professionals, but it's also good to go to your pastor. It's good to go to an elder. I don't necessarily mean a church elder, but it could be that. It's just somebody older and wise who can give you counsel and encourage you and pray for you and love you. But I think what's happened in our society of technique and commercialization, we think, if I've got a problem, I've got to go to an expert. And an expert is someone I pay money for a service. And the reality is, for thousands of years, humans have gone to experts for help and not paid money for it. They've gone to people who love them. And I think we need to return to that.
That's good.
Oh, fabulous. Thank you so much.
Oh, man. That question was right in line with my question. I was going to say 15 years ago, people would say, you're in therapy? What's wrong with you? And now today, you're not in therapy?
Yeah.
What's wrong with you? It's changed very quickly. And I know a lot of pastors who also struggle with that. And not that we want to put the pastors against the therapist, but I do know a lot of pastors who struggle with feeling like any kind of wisdom or even authority they had to speak into their prisoner's life has been vacated because it happens in the therapist office more often than not.
Yeah, and that's one of the I'm trying to walk a lot of fine lines in this book.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the most delicate part of writing this book is trying to walk these fine lines, because on the one hand, repeatedly I say, if you are suffering, seek professional help. And I believe that. And I believe that there's value in psychology and psychiatry. But I also want to say, gosh, we kind of have a weird view of these things. And maybe it's not entirely healthy. Maybe not everyone needs therapy. Maybe everyone needs someone to talk to and to give them wise counsel, but maybe not everyone needs therapy. I mean, it could be that what we've done is we've, you know, as you were saying, Fitch, we've swung the pendulum the other direction. We've gone to another extreme. There's this been this reaction to the fundamentalist view of therapy, which said it's toxic and dangerous and ungodly. And now we feel like if you're not in therapy, there's something wrong with you. And, you know, many people do need to go to therapy, but it could be that we are, again, as I said earlier, professionalizing something that is just a natural part of human community. And so I would encourage people, you know, if you're going through a period of deep depression or anxiety, you know, definitely seek professional help, but also talk to a mentor. Because there's a way in which, and I talk about this, and this is one of the dangerous things in my book, there's a way in which we can actually fall in love with our own suffering. And I was scared to write this because it sounds like it's diminishing or discounting or invalidating somebody's suffering, but it's a reality. There are people who fall in love with their suffering, who come to identify so much with their mental illness or their suffering that it actually becomes a thing, that they actually don't get the treatment they need and recover. They stay in this space of perpetual suffering because they identify with it and because it feels safe to them. That's a real danger. It's not something that I think most people are experiencing, but it's a real danger.
Yeah.
And the professionalization of mental health, I think, has encouraged that so that some people online, in particular, are using it as a badge of honor. And I haven't been, I don't use TikTok because I think it's toxic. But I have, you know, what I've seen from Instagram and I've seen what I've heard from TikTok, there's a lot of people who are sort of basking in their mental illness and giving unprofessional advice about how to deal with it and talking about it in these sorts of ways, where it's really about identity formation. It's not about human suffering. It's about identity formation. And that's a real risk.
That is absolutely gold right there, folks. Gold. The book is On Getting Out of Bed, The Burden and Gift of Living by Alan Noble. It came out last year. It's absolutely number one book for every pastor to read who's sorting out mental illness. It walks these fine lines that Alan just finished talking about. I got one last question, Alan. I'm a holiness Pentecostal. Are you thinking about getting saved from your Reformed understanding of Christianity?
Have you seen this beard? No.
Because I think God's been present in this podcast and he's calling you to the other side. Holiness Pentecostal. Okay, sorry, Mike. I don't know why I went there, but I just had to see if I would get anywhere on that. Folks, we want to thank you for being with us on the podcast today. We want to thank Alan Noble for being on this podcast. Yes. I personally want to thank Alan Noble for writing this book, and I know it's already helped a lot of people. I hope you rush out and get it. It'll be in the show notes, the link to buy the book. We'll put some other resources there on there as well. Mike, any other announcements?
Hey, it's always good to plug the theology and mission lectures coming up June 9th and 10th, Jonathan Tran, who Alan has interacted with from Alan's days at Baylor. Jonathan Tran will be giving the lectures this year, so sign up.
Sign up and make sure you get in on the breakfast. Folks, it's been really great being with you. We're doing 8 of these in this tranche of episodes. I hope you stay with us. Give us a good review. But for now, it's Mike Moore. Wait, I'm supposed to let you say that. It's
Mike Moore
and Dave Fitch over and out. Till next time.